My name is Matt Dabbs. I'm an associate minister in St. Petersburg, Florida, and I've been working with young adults there for 7 years this week. And we have kind of an interesting group of us here. I'm kind of more the congregational context, working with 20s and 30s in some local congregation, trying to multiply it through that approach. And we have Eric Brown with us here. Eric, you want to intro yourself?
Yes. I am the preaching minister at Campus Church of Christ in Gainesville, Florida. And first 2 years I was there, I worked with college students. In the past 9 years, I've been a preaching minister. And we're experimenting with some ways of maybe pushing out beyond the building walls. I'll talk a little bit about why we did it and very little about how we transitioned.
I'm Charles Kaiser. I'm a church planter in Dallas, Texas. We moved about 5 years ago to start a church in the uptown area, just north of downtown, where lots of 20 and 30-something young professionals live, work, and play. And I've been resourced by an organization called Mission Alive that trains church planters all over North America. So we're a network of simple churches or house churches that has made a primary focus of us is reaching out to young adults, 20 and 30-something.
All right, so we kind of have this progression going here. We want to play off of this progression to a small degree. When you think about in the early church, in the book of Acts, Acts 1:8, there's that verse that's key to the book of Acts where Jesus says that you'll be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth. As we were discussing this topic and we were discussing our own ministries, we started realizing that we actually, within our own context, fit that progression. Not so much as a geographical progression, but as a cultural progression. You think about Jerusalem, the temple, the institutional nature of the congregation there with the temple complex, and my own ministry being within the congregational setting. And then Eric's kind of starting to get out there into Judea and Samaria a little bit. He's kind of away from looking, edging out there a little further, and then Charles is all the way out to the ends of the earth. And what's interesting in Acts, what's that?
In Dallas.
In Dallas. Yeah, that is. That's up there. In the book of Acts, you know, some people ask why it never tells us what happened to Paul. Because we really like to talk about Paul for a good reason. But it never tells us what happens to Paul. What it does is, though, it tells us by the end of the book of Acts that Paul has made it to Rome. And it's really a fulfillment of Acts 1:8. It's really where the book is headed. It is at the end of the book of Acts, the gospel has made it to the cultural center of the world. And so as we thought about our own ministry, we kind of have seen this progression. So we're going to actually talk a little bit about that. If you're more in the Jerusalem setting, if you're in a congregational setting of the insiders, the church, how do you reach out to and grow and disciple the faith of the church? And then you think about those who have left the church, who are church but are no longer present. They don't attend anymore. You know, they know what it was like to live in Jerusalem. They knew what it was like to worship at the temple, but they're no longer present. They've left us. They may not have left faith completely, but they have left the building. And so we want to know how to reclaim those people. And so I'm going to talk some about that. And then Eric and Charles are going to kind of branch out into our Judea, Samaria, and the ends of the earth after that. And I want to move into counseling mode for about a minute and a half. Because in the past, when we've had these discussions, and we've had Q&A at the end, and we've typically kind of gotten barraged by parents who have so much hurt over their kids or ministers who have some guilt or regret over things that have happened or whatever the case may be. There's a lot of hurt with this whole situation. And I just want you to know that what you're going through is normal. You know, if you have some anxiety or some past hurt about this, or maybe your kid is no longer attending and people, you know, are asking you about that, I want to normalize that a little bit. I want to help take away the guilt, and instead of just kind of feeling so guilty about all that, kind of be more proactive and talk about some things that we can do. And, you know, the best statistics are that by 18 to 28-year-olds, roughly two-thirds have left. And that is a problem. That's a big-time problem. We think about the word was mentioned earlier. I don't know if it was a keynote or not, but the word was mentioned of legacy in one of the classes. And if you think about the legacy that your church is going to leave, it's completely dependent upon reaching this generation. If you don't reach this generation, how will you accomplish the legacy that your church hopes? Hopefully you have a vision. Hopefully you have a mission. Hopefully you think you're going somewhere. And without this group, 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road, 30 years down the road, without the leaders that are actually present within this age group who are desiring and zealous for something to do. With that missing piece coming down the road, it's going to be impossible for you to achieve the legacy that you would like your congregation to have achieved. And so it's vitally important that we reach this group. We know there's a lot of reasons they leave. Some maybe didn't have their faith passed down intentionally enough. And so maybe, as Erica said in the past when we presented this, maybe that we never, quote, had them to begin with. We kind of counted them present, and so we thought, well, we've got them, they're here. But then when they hit 18 years old, they kind of left the building, and so maybe we never had them in the first place. Others just live life incongruent with the gospel, and they don't want to live in the middle of that hypocrisy, in the middle of that inconsistency, and so they just leave. They go out and experiment, and hopefully we get them back. We'll talk about reclaiming some people in that situation. And then others, and this is some of the saddest ones, are others who have been a part of the church but don't see the church as a viable or meaningful or powerful expression of what they believe the kingdom ought to look like. And so we've said in the past, you know, the church, our model for church is the book of Acts. These guys go read Acts and they'll say, why can't we be more like that? We would say, well, yeah, we're just like that. Well, they're reading about the zeal and boldness and mission and going out and all this. And then we say, come, just be a part, just attend this and attend that. You know, and they don't really see what we're saying when we say Acts is our model. And so earlier on the opening night, there was a mention of these two prayers that I just wanted to mention. I didn't write them down word for word, but there was a mention of that prayer labyrinth here in Malibu. Anybody catch that? Where the two prayers where he said, when you walk in, he said the prayer is for you to let it go. Let go of the things that need to be let go of. And the second prayer was something along the lines of for God to give you the vision of what he's trying to bless you with or what he's trying to put in your hands. Something along those lines, right? I want you to think about those two questions in terms of reaching out to young adults from a congregational perspective. What is it that your church needs to let go of in order to be successful in this area? I really want you to think about that. I'm going to ask you some questions, and most of these questions are actually, we have a handout here we're going to give you. That one's not on the handout. I want you to ask yourself that. As a congregation, what do we need to let go of in order to really reach out to this generation? And the second question really inspires us to really want to deal honestly with the first question is, what is God trying to do with your church in terms of reaching these people? What vision does he have for the future of your church when it comes to reaching and using this generation for many years to come? As we get excited about the answer to the second question, we start getting ready to deal with the difficult answer to that first question. We don't have to let go of things. You're probably in a church where there's some two or three things that if you could just kind of get it behind you, you know, you might be able to make some progress. And so we're going to have to let some of those things go. And we have to know what's negotiable and what's not. And, you know, young adults, they're so good at sniffing out a hypocrite. They're so good at sniffing out someone being fake. And so when we start saying, yeah, we're going to have to introduce this, or we're going to have to change worship like that, or we're going to have to compromise this, or we can't teach that doctrine, they're going to see right through that. One thing you're going to see with what we're going to say is we're not going to ever ask you to be any less biblical. In fact, we're going to say it's extremely important for you to be as biblical as possible. I just had this conversation with the lady over here. I don't remember your name, I'm sorry. What is it?
Yvette.
You know, how when we have these intergenerational, or not even intergenerational, when you have 18 to 35-year-olds all in the same room, and some have kids and some don't, and some are married and some are not, what's the commonality there? It's teaching textually, applying Scripture to the lives of whoever's in the room. So anyway, we'll get to more of that here in just a little bit. What do you need to let go of, and what's God trying to get you to take hold of? Let me ask you, let me just say this first before I go there. I had a guy who called the other day, a friend of mine, who they were in the middle of trying to talk to all the members in their church. The elders decided it's time for us to contact every single person. And so he went through the church directory, and he started noticing when he got to the names of the young adults, none of them were there anymore. And he didn't know it. He had no idea. So he went to the young adult class on Sunday morning. They used to have about 20, 25 in it. There were four or five people in that class. Said, I had no idea. And I think one of the things on the front end of this is, as we start to deal with this, is we have to start dealing with reality. We have to identify what's really going on. Where are we really? It's not just that it looks good on paper, that we can just think that we're someplace where we're not. We have this, it's kind of like being in recovery. You have a problem, and sometimes we get codependent and nobody wants to talk about what the problem is. We keep doing the same things over and over, and it's kind of a sickness, you know. And so we have to really identify it. Somebody has to shine the spotlight on it and say, this is a real issue here. We're not going to really be able to move ahead until we deal with these spiritual issues that we're facing here. Somebody's got to be bold enough to bring that up. And sometimes we don't have safe environments in which to say those things, because you know you're going to get blasted if you do. And so we hesitate. But somebody's going to have to say it. Somebody has to identify it in order for us to move forward. There's a model of change. I'm going to have it on the handout for you after the break. After Charles speaks. There's something called the trans-theoretical model of change. I'm going to grab a handout here so I can mention these stages of change to you. And the point I want to make here is we're not all starting from the same place when it comes to making an impact on this generation. When it comes to change, you know, we're kind of a little bit afraid of change. We're kind of already inbred in the Church of Christ, like change is bad to some degree. I don't mean to broad brush, but that's kind of how I grew up. And so when you hear change, it's like, ooh, you know, were we doing something wrong? No, we don't want to say we were doing something the wrong way, so change is kind of scary. But the trans-theoretical model of change basically says there are five levels of change. The first level is pre-contemplation. This is, I don't even know that there's a problem, so I have no intention of making a change. That's where my friend was who called me before he looked at the church role. Right? Once he looked at the church role, he moved from pre-contemplation to contemplation. He realized that there was a problem. He was wondering what to do about it, but he didn't know what to do yet. Okay? He's contemplating it. Stage number three that I'm going to give you again on the handout here in a minute. Preparation. I'm intending to take a specific action within the next month. That's stage three. Stage four is the action stage. I am now actively making the moves and making the changes and taking action on the change that I think that needs to take place. And then the fifth stage is maintenance. How do I prevent relapse? Okay? So you have pre-contemplation. I don't even know there's a problem. I have contemplation. I'm aware there's a problem, but I'm not doing anything yet. I have preparation. Well, I'm starting to take action at least within the next month. I got a plan. Fourth is the action stage. I'm actually doing something to solve this problem. And fifth is maintenance. And the reason we need maintenance is because if you're in any counseling circles, there's this term called homeostasis. Homeo is kind of the same. Stasis is state. Homeostasis is just that we tend to revert back to those same states over time. So you've probably seen this in church where you say, you know, we gotta sing some newer songs or whatever, and your song leader starts singing three or four new songs, and guess what? After about 6 months, where are you? You're right back to all the old way of doing it. It's hard to break out of those loops. It takes just a tremendous amount of effort to break into something new and bring about the change that needs to be made and maintain it. Sometimes maybe you have a vision for how you think things could be, but actually implementing it and maintaining it is really difficult. Maybe you've taken action on your vision, but it slipped right back into where it was. And the maintenance has been what's difficult. Now, why do I bring that up? Every last one of you in this room is at a slightly different point in that process. And so what I don't want you to hear is I'm going to outline some of our story in a minute. I'm going to teach some principles and ask you some questions to help you work through some of those principles for your own context. And the reason that we're taking this approach is because I don't want you to hear me say, let's take the Northwest cookie cutter or the Gainesville cookie cutter or the Dallas cookie cutter and just stamp it down on my congregation and tell my elders, this is what it looks like and we're going to do it just like this guy or that guy, because it's not going to work. This has to be yours. This has to be you partnering with God and where you see God working in order to move ahead. So that's why I mentioned that. You're not all in the same place. And so it's important to identify your strengths. It's important to identify what level of change you feel like you're at in order to know what's next. So let me ask you this. Here's a question for you. What have been the main... Again, this is on the handout, okay? So don't sweat it. What's been the main factor that you believe has resulted in your young adults not maintaining their faith into their adult years? Okay? That's an important question to answer. Okay, so why have they not maintained their faith? Why hasn't it, quote, worked? Okay? But first you have to understand, what does it mean, worked? How do you define worked? Is that they attend? is that they're faithful disciples of Jesus who are growing in their faith. I mean, how do you define that? I think for so long, sometimes we've defined what's worked as, well, we've got a vibrant youth group, and there are 65 people in a youth group. But then you look at where they've gone, what the track record is, and you say, then they just drop off. Well, what's happening back here? It looks vibrant, and it looks fun, and there's biblical teaching happening. But are the most important elements here really taking place? Are they present? What does it really mean for it to work? Sometimes the things we think are working may not be working quite as well as we think. So let me ask you this question. Back when we thought things were healthy, and it really wasn't working the way you thought maybe, why not? Did your youth ministry, did your young adult ministry produce the desired result? Now, if 2/3 of your young adults leave when they hit 18, it's probably not producing the desired result. And I'm not saying that to make you feel guilty. I'm saying that to just open up our eyes a little bit and say, you know what, if I'm going to really dive into this thing and take it on, I really have to deal with reality. So, you know what, find out. Who's left? Give them a call. Talk to them. Where'd you go? How's it going? Why'd you leave? You know, just talk to them. Find out. Start developing a relationship with them. Understand their situation. And you're going to find that there's a whole lot of those guys who have left the church, but they haven't left Jesus. Okay? You're going to find that a lot of those guys who still have faith, but they kind of lost some faith in the bride. And that's sad. That's sad. So we have to work on some of those things. So let me tell you a little bit of our story here in Northwest. We came to Northwest in 2006. Our elders basically had renovated the nursery a couple of years prior, and there weren't any kids in the nursery. So they said, man, you know, we're starting to notice this continues on for some years. We're going to have some real issues here. So can you come work with our young adults? And so we came to Northwest, started working with the young adults, started just finding out, you know, first who's here, who's still coming. I mean, and I tell these guys, even still, the ones who are even still coming now that the group is bigger, I let them know, you guys are the exceptions, you know. Where are your friends? Why are you still here? What is different about you? What is it that God's doing in your life that you have maintained your faith into your late 20s, early 30s, late 30s? Why are you still here? Praise the Lord that you're still here. Help me understand what it is different about you than your friends. Don't be afraid to have those kind of conversations. So we started pretty traditionally. We basically said, well, who's around? Started having conversations with them. You know, started getting to know them, build relationships with them. And we decided, really, for us, the place that we started was, we said, we are going to start a quality Bible class. Now, I'm going to tell you, this is as institutional as you want to take it, okay? And that's good, because that's where many of you are, and you're wondering, where do we start? What do we do? Okay, we make this your own. So what we did was, we said, let's make a quality Bible class where people are welcome and free to explore their faith in a safe environment. Okay? If these guys are still here, some of them are on the fringe, what do they need? They need to ask the questions that they really have. And when they ask them, they need someone there who can shepherd them through that in a safe and honest and a fair way to get them out on the other side of that. I mean, if they're still present, this is the saddest thing. If they're still present and they start asking their faith question, and there's someone there who has enough, whatever you want to call that, to shoot them down in the middle of asking the tough questions that they have, which happens. Anyone ever seen that happen? It happens, guys. That's one of the saddest things. This guy is still here. He's still hanging in there despite all the stuff and all his friends have gone. And he asks the tough question and somebody just shoots him full of holes because they're afraid of the question. You know, so that was one of the things we decided on the front end, is let's make the safest environment with biblical teaching where we can bring these guys along in their faith. They are welcome to be who they are, ask whatever question that they have, and be completely safe in it. And you can say safe all day long, but if you don't treat people that way, they're going to just not even listen to you anymore. And so we started branching out from that Bible class. We started having other events. We started doing monthly devotionals, service projects. And there came a point in time within that when I started realizing that the group, once they had an environment to connect in, that they saw was actually engaging in some kingdom things and some social things that they could have an identity with and connect with, started inviting them, calling them, emailing them, Facebooking them. Come on, hey, we have a place for you. These were the old Jerusalem kids, right? There's something going on at the temple again, if you want to use that terminology. Hey, come on back. And a lot of them did. A lot of them did. Because there was something for them. it started growing to the point where I realized that unless I start handing off ministry to them, it's going to stay exactly where it's at. So one of the shifts that we made once it got into the 20s or so, about 25 people, was we started handing off responsibilities. And so we actually made formal roles. It's something I learned from Donnie Dillon in Gainesville. Started making formal roles and titles for them. Yeah, as mentioned in somebody before class, I was hearing a mention of like elder equipping and elder training and future elder training maybe yesterday. And what they were talking about were people in their 50s and 60s who were kind of elder material, who just needed to be trained. And I didn't say anything, but as I was listening, I thought, there are 25-year-olds in your church who need to hear this too. They're going to be your leaders. They're going to take this church to the next place. We have to start giving them responsibility. We have to start handing it off to them. And so start handing off, hey, can you take 6 months of this? Can you organize our devotionals for the next 3 months? Can you start looking for service events for us to go out into our community and take this on? Actually, initially we learned it was really better to do that in pairs. And then once that guy got done with it, he kind of take the next guy and help him see how to lead that role. So they start mentoring and teaching each other in those roles. Okay? And what ends up happening is instead of me inviting them and me being the central focal point of all invitation, guess who starts inviting them? They do. Why? They're invested. They're in charge. Who do they want to come? They're friends. When I plan it and I tell them what's going on, it's, well, maybe, maybe not. I don't know. But if you're running it, what are you going to do? And when the next guy's running it, what are you going to do? You remember how it was to plan that thing, right? And so people start coming and they have a place to connect and a place to find identity. And so it became not just a ministry for them or a ministry to them. It became a ministry by them. Where they can make a difference. This generation is very, very serious about making a difference and being involved in movements and things that are greater than themselves. So let me ask you this question. What opportunities to make a significant kingdom impact can you invite young adults into? Let me say that again. It's on the handout. I'm going to give this to you in a bit. What opportunities to make a significant kingdom impact can you invite young adults into? We have to develop them. We have to use them. And let me ask you this question. What are you going to do with them once you've given them leadership responsibility? What are you going to do with them when they make a mistake? They goof it all up? What are we going to model for them? What are we going to teach them? What are they going to learn? Not just in us saying, can you do this, or let me delegate that, or can... And we would give them specific job description. Just so there's no question. It's not blurry or nebulous. You say, I need you to do this for 3 months. Make it simple. Okay? But when they mess up, what are you going to do? We had a young adult who was dating, a guy who was a non-Christian. And they were living together, engaged to be married, pregnant, and Missy and I counseled them, premarital counseling. And we started talking with him. He wasn't really connected with the church or anything like that. And, you know, the natural tendency is to say, well, hey, this is wrong, you should do this, and everything. Well, we didn't know him. We spent about 5 weeks or so in counseling, building rapport with them, and getting to know him, talking with him about this. Until about the fifth or sixth counseling session, we finally brought it up. We said, you know what? You know we've been talking. You know everything that we've been saying has been in your best interest. You know that we're on your side. So there's something we really need to talk about here. You know, what is God's intention? And what is your level of commitment, you know, within cohabitation? What does that show about your level of commitment? What does that show about your willingness to be with, in a sexual sense with someone outside the confines of marriage, looking ahead, once you say your I do's, what does that show about your future? You know, we're talking about the statistics and the Bible and everything else, and he decided that they would separate until their marriage. We dealt with them respectfully, lovingly, and we've had probably 6 or 8 more conversations of that sense, and every one that I've known of has separated prior to their marriage every time. But you got to deal with them well in their moment of weakness, their moment of vulnerability. If someone is in a vulnerable state, and especially anybody, but especially in this young adult time, you're trying to figure these things out, and someone comes along with no rapport, no respect, or anything, and starts just blasting on these guys, they're going to jump ship on you. But if you're patient and loving and kind and have the fruits of the Spirit, then it's going to make a tremendous difference as you work alongside them and help them to grow and disciple them. Now, Tom's a deacon at our church. Yeah. What a blessing that is. What a blessing that is. He's a leader. You know. Let me ask you this question. How will they know that they have a voice in the decisions of the church? Okay, so we want these guys to grow up. We want them to mature. We want them to be leaders. Let's start treating them that way. Let's start giving them a responsibility. We make a committee. We make a building committee. Let's get their input. Let's put one or two of them on it. We had a situation a couple of years ago where we had some of our young adults who were very serious about their faith, and they had read a book that really shook them. They shook their whole understanding of what church is. And they came to me and they said, man, we have all these questions, and we just don't know what to do. Can we just talk to you about it? I sat down with them and talked to them about it. And I said, you know, I think you really need to talk to the elders about this, but let me talk to the elders first. Okay, I'll let you know when it's time. All right. I love my elders, but I don't think they would mess this one up. But I just really wanted to make sure that they were everybody was going to be okay. So I went and talked to my elders, and I said, you know what? These guys are serious. They're going to ask you some really tough questions. You know what? Let me say it this way. We have challenged them to be serious about their faith, and they took that challenge seriously. You understand when I say that, what I mean by that? If we're going to challenge them to take their faith seriously and they come back to us with serious questions, we shouldn't say, oh, you can't ask that kind of stuff here. We should say, that's exactly right. You're asking all the right questions, right? Because that's what we've been asking you to do, is take your faith seriously and evaluate things and come to conclusions on your own and land with Jesus on these things. And so these guys came with some serious questions about how we do church. And so I went to my elders and I said, look, these guys are serious. And I'm going to ask you to do one thing. I really think they need to come and talk to you. I think you need to listen to them. But please, if I can just say one thing, don't say anything to them. Just listen to them. Nod your head. Say we love you. And say we'll get back with you. And that's exactly what they did. And when those guys left the room, they felt loved. They felt listened to. They had expected the elders to come back and say, that's crazy. Or that's, I can't believe you'd ask that. Or, you know, all this stuff. They didn't get any of it. They just got complete acceptance and love. Scheduled a follow-up meeting, they came in. We actually had the discussion we needed to have. Everybody was ready to have it. But they were treated with love. They were treated with kindness. They were treated with respect. They were put on the same table with the elders, and nobody was looking down on those guys for asking the questions that they had. They were safe. They were respected. And these guys are going to be leaders. Some of them are leaders in the church. If we want leaders, we've got to start treating people like that. We can't wait until they're 60 and start looking around and trying to figure out who the next elders are. We have to start developing these guys. Let me just leave you with a couple of concepts here before I hand this off to Eric. So we talked about kind of creating environments, creating a quality Bible class, having safety there, doing events outside of Bible class. There's a couple of things here that I just want to kind of throw at you that might be paradigm shifting a little bit for you. One of them is intergenerational connection within the body. One of the problems we have in young adult ministry is we tend to isolate, and so we kind of create churches within churches. And so you kind of have your youth group, and you got your young adult group, and you got everybody else. And so one of the things we've done is we've tried to really encourage intergenerational connection. And so, you know, we have like a panel. We've had the elders or different members of the church come into our class and do Q&As to get to know them better and learn and grow from their faith. I'll tell our young adult class, I'll say, look, don't come for a quarter. Don't come for a year. Go somewhere else. Go to some other class. Get to know some other people. Don't spend all your time insulated and isolated. Another thing we do is we kind of create bridge people. One of the problems that we've had is whenever people get out of youth group age and they start getting into the adult years, is we've 18 to 28, 60, whatever percent leave, right? And one of the things that we try to do is we try to make that connection with them in advance. And so we take some of our 20s and 30s and we send them down into the youth group to mentor them, to teach their class. So the youth group will, the youth leader will teach another class or teach the middle school, whatever, for a while. And some of our 20s and 30s will come in on Wednesday night, Sunday morning, and actually teach our youth classes in order to make those relationships in advance so that the generation gap, gets so much smaller. Because when it comes time to get into the 20s and 30s ministry, they already know you. They already feel that connection. And so we're trying to make that bridge in advance. Okay. Let me just ask you this last question here, and I'm going to hand it over to Eric. After hearing all of this, what are you most afraid might happen? Okay, what are you most afraid might happen? And what do you dream about happening? What's your vision for this? Do you have a vision for where you see this going? Okay, what do you have to give up, and what's God going to hand back to you? And I just want to say last is just be patient. It's going to take a lot of patience. We've been doing this for this week, I think in about 4 days, it's going to be 7 years. And, you know, we've grown. We've had a lot of success, and our numbers have gone up, and we have now deacons out of our 20s and 30s ministry, and a lot of good things have happened. But, man, if, if you give up after a year or two or 3 years and say it's not quite what I envisioned it to be, what's your legacy going to be? Where's the church going to be? You know, so I would really encourage you to be very patient in this. Be ready for mistakes. You're going to learn a lot from what how you move ahead and what dynamics you have based on how you deal with failures. How do you treat people safely within those failures and how you lead. So I'm going to go ahead and hand it off to Eric here for a minute. And then we'll take a break up here.
Can I have a question?
Sure. You mind, Eric? I've got
a couple minutes.
What are the tough questions that this generation is asking?
Tough questions?
You
really want to know?
I do.
Okay. Tough questions are very much questions about the institution of the church, about our institutional expression of the church. Is this really what church is supposed to be? How is our mission reflected in what we see the church visibly doing? And so one thing we realized was, you know, if you look at a pie chart of your time as a congregation, and you say, what do we spend our time doing? Bible study and worship get about 9/10 of that pie, and everything else gets about 1/10 of that pie. And we said, at some one point, we talked about that, and we said, we are not happy with that. We are not okay with that. We should be very unsettled by that. You know, and so they would say, well, why do we study the Bible on Sunday morning Bible class? We get it in a sermon. We get it Sunday night. We study the Bible Wednesday night. We have another study during the week. And we study the Bible like 19 times a week. We have no outreach to the poor. We have no way of serving the prisoners, those downtrodden. You know, so one thing we did at one point in time is we looked at the ministry of Jesus and we said, who did Jesus spend his time ministering to? We made a list. We said, okay, here's six groups. Luke 4 and other places. Six groups. We said, okay, take all the people in our group. We divided up into six groups. We said, you guys take care of the poor. And during our Bible class on Sunday morning, we would actually split into two classes, and one group would kind of plot what they were going to do for that ministry outside the walls looking out. Okay? And that's kind of the out-in dynamic. And that's one of the problems they have, and the question they have, why do we look in so much? We are so inward, spiritual, navel-gazing focused. We just sit here and we look internally 90-whatever% of our time, and there's all this God has for us out there looking out, and we just are not looking for it. You know, the opportunities abound. So these are some of the disconnects and the tensions that they really feel, because they're looking for mission, and they're just not seeing it in the day-to-day operation of the church. They may be there, but they're just not there.
Okay. Quick question. I agree with a lot of the methods that you're doing. We've tried to implement several of those as far as delegation and assigning roles and all of those things. However, this generation is completely, what we've noticed, non-committal. And they're waiting for the next best offer. So therefore, none of them are responding in time to plan a social event, plan a spiritual event, plan anything, because they're waiting to see if something secularly might be more fun that they could do. Or even something within the church body might be more fun or more interesting to them. So how do you deal with they are completely non-committal. Married, single, 20s, 30s, it doesn't matter. It's this whole XY generation right now that's just, they want to make sure they're not missing anything by committing to something.
Yeah. I think Adele had mentioned that too, that you just said the same thing?
I did.
It was like verbatim. She said exactly the same thing.
Really,
no, that's so true. And part of that's a maturity issue. Part of that's our own patience with them. You know, and we would say back when I was 19, I was probably the exact same way, and here we are. You know, so I think that's part of it. I think part of it's just good communication. Why are we doing this? There's a really good video on YouTube, Simon Sinek, of Start With Why. I think it's Simon Sinek. You know, we don't always talk about why. We just say, hey, we don't always like load it up with, what, here's our spiritual priority, here's what it's reflecting. Just that communication aspect can be helpful to them to say, oh, that's why we're doing it. But we would think it'd be obvious. It seems obvious to us. You know, sometimes those things need to be stated. I wish I had the perfect answer for you.
One thing I heard in your narrative that you do really well is you give bite-sized opportunity for commitment. You know, like a pilot project kind of thing for the next 3 months, for the next 6 months. Because lots of young adults don't know if they'll be around, you know, 3 or 6 months from now. I hear that, what you're saying. I think that's been really helpful for us, too. When we ask for commitment, that it's not forever. It's for the next month or 3 months or 6 months.
And that's the other thing that involves them. You're talking about involvement, really. The involvement level of this is mine versus this is yours, and you're trying to convince me to come into it. Yeah.
You know, here's something about that worked for us. I learned this from a professional development coach.
joining, and I started teaching, and I just asked, we ran 3 months, and I said, I want you to tell me what 3 things absolutely have to happen this summer in order for you to get to the end of August and look back and say that was a fabulous class. I didn't want to miss it. And had them meet without any older people there at all. They said they wanted a retreat, they wanted a special Wednesday night service, and they wanted Church of Christ 101 class. But anyway, we worked on that. but we accomplished those. We accomplished those deals. And because they came up with the 3 things and they had a timeline, they went for it. But if we had said, we're going to do these 3 things, we would have got your mind from the stuff.
And I hope this doesn't sound negatively evaluating of what you're doing, because I appreciate what you're doing. You know, to say, well, you should try this, you know, and you're certainly doing some things you should be doing. You've got some numbers there with what you're doing. That's definitely to be committed. You know, I think that goes back to that phrase of ministry, by them rather than a ministry to them. You know, I think that's kind of that transition that gets more of them involved.
If you write those questions down, we're going to have some time at the end. We maybe have come back to them. I resonate with what you're saying, okay? One thing that's helped us, we've had to have smaller groups of people who are committed, and I've learned that there is a general lack of commitment, especially to the institution or to the ministry, but they will make commitments to each other, okay? And that's helped. We've actually created little triads, and so if the other two will show up, then I'll show up, okay? Let me say this quickly. It's always hard to prepare for these because people are on different levels. Some of you guys are reading the same books. You've tried some of the same things we've tried. I was thinking to myself, there are two types of books I like to read. Some of them are the books that give me new information. But other books I like to read, they're basically stating what I've been sensing. It's just putting it better than I've been able to, you know, and it helps me communicate. So if I don't give you any new ideas or paradigms, hopefully I can say something that'll help you communicate it back to your elders or church leaders. Let me start out with a story. I teach adjuncts. I'm a full-time minister, church minister, but I also teach adjuncts at a large community college in Gainesville, Florida, the feeder school in the U.S. And I teach in the student development department, and they have a workshop. They brought in this young professor. He was 30 years old, really exciting. Apparently he had high teacher ratings, and so they brought him in to talk to us about what we can do to actually reach this young generation, all right, in terms of teaching. And, I mean, he was vibrant. He had a little hair spiked up, you know, dude. He was bubbly. I'm on the Myers Briggs. I'm an ISTJ. So I don't have all that energy. It takes way too much. But I remember in this workshop, what he did, and I was one of the younger ones in my mid-30s. Then there was a girl I was in the counseling program with the U.S. She's 28. And we were the only two relatively young ones there. Everyone else was middle age. So what we did in the middle of the workshop, he asked us to take out a sheet of paper. He said, I want you to write down, I'm going to give you 5 minutes. I want you to write down all of the problems with this generation. I'll give you 5 minutes. I mean, no one had any problems. He said, I want you to talk about it with the person next to you. And man, they went on. He said, I want to just give you 5 minutes. They went on for 10 minutes. 10:50, he had to stop. And now what I want you to do, give you 5 minutes, I want you to write down what's good. What do you see about this generation? Particularly about this generation, that's good. Oh man, people looked up and and then you say, okay, talk to the person next to you, and they say, well, what did you get out of it? You know, it wasn't quite that bad, but it was almost that bad. Then he asked us to talk out loud. All right, so they went on with everything that was wrong with this generation. Then they said, okay, what's good? People couldn't come up with hardly anything. My 28-year-old friend, this is my generation. So she spoke up, listed 3 or 4 things. And the people started butting in. The other teacher said, yeah, but you, da, 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 da. I thought, okay, that's a parable for the church. Because the truth is, we will never reach a group of people we don't like. I mean, that's bottom line, okay? If I have a mission organization, all right, if I have a mission organization, and I have somebody who comes and, you know, let's say they want to go to Kenya, you know, let's say, I say, what do you know about Kenya? If you stay in Kenya, yeah, let me tell you, they need the gospel because they, no, that's negative. Okay, what do you like about the culture? If they can't really give me anything, I don't think they're going to be all that successful. I think one of the reasons we're not reaching, one of the reasons, I think there are a number of reasons, that we're not reaching this generation is because a lot of people who are in leadership, who are older, they really just don't like them. Now, they don't want to go to hell. Okay? Right? You don't want to go to hell, so they love them in that sense. But you can always sense when a group of people don't like you. Especially if you are, now catch this word, if you are a minority. Now don't think I'm saying it just from a minority in terms of numbers or power, right? And the younger generation, they are minorities in terms of union numbers in our churches, as well as power, okay? So that's something that I've been going around, and I was teaching the adult class at the church, and I did the exercise. I said, write down what you like about the church, what you don't like, all right? I'm going to talk about moving beyond Jerusalem, beyond the synagogue, and I'm going to explain what I mean by this. There are two questions I've begun to ask when I say working with a young person, when I'm relating with them. One of the biggest life changes for me, I'm a Texas boy. Texas A&M, went off to ACU, then I went to Gainesville 11 years ago next month. And after being in Gainesville, after working with church for 2 years, I went to the University of Florida, and I was actually a full-time student in the counseling program, which was really a secular humanist program. So there were actually a lot of people, a lot of students who were very liberal. I noticed that this was like the anti-seminary seminary. People who probably would have gone into ministry, but they hated churches, they didn't like Christians. Okay. And so I decided that I wanted to live in this community, spend time with. And there were a couple of questions that I began to ask. One was, where is a person at in terms of their view of what I'm going to call American church culture? How do they feel about it? Okay? And this positive 1, 2, 3, you know, the further along you are on the spectrum, the more you kind of like American church culture. And then maybe how far away are they? I had some friends. I have friends now. We have a dinner once a month. We call it the vegan club, right? Because they don't eat anything that comes from animals. Right? And a number of my friends are, I would say, they're really anti-church culture. And so I kind of had that question in the back of my mind when I'm relating with people. But there's a second question. That second question is, where are they at in relation to Jesus? How do they feel about Jesus? How do they feel about discipleship? Okay? And so I've kind of been in my mind, I kind of put them on this spectrum. I think one of the problems that we have is that we have a tendency to equate where a person is on American church culture with where they are in relation to Jesus. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. I looked younger when I started 11 years ago. I had more hair and didn't have the gray. When you look younger, when you come to a church, you always have a lot of parents who will come up to you and they want you to try to make a connection with their children. I still have parents who want me to do that, and my heart goes out to them. But I remember one time a mother coming up to me and she said, you know, we raised our children in church. They were here every time, the doors were open. Could you just make a connection with them? We want them to come back. And the thought occurred to me, these kids, 18 years, they were in church 3 times a week. And something didn't click. That we would have to do more than just get them back into the building. Something was going to have to be different. Okay, something would have to be different. What disturbs me is that most of our churches, we usually just think in terms of getting them back in the building. We get them involved in church as long as they're not doing anything too crazy, or jacking up or getting drunk. We usually exhale. We think everything is okay. I think one of the big shifts we need to make is separate these two. How do they feel about, when I say American church culture, how do they feel about how we worship? All right? The idea that you would worship sitting in pews, that you would actually take communion facing the back of somebody's head, okay? I mean, we don't think that's strange. I think First Century Christians would really consider that to be a strange thing. Okay? We have people who will call our building all the time, and they'll ask us, do I have to dress up to go to your church? And our answer is, no, you don't have to dress up. Right? We have people who dress. Some people wear suits, some people don't. And I always think to myself, that's true. We have people who are short. We have a few people who are short. But people in power, right? People who are in leadership, they're going to be dressed a little more formally. And these young people, they pick up on that. All right? So when I talk about dress, I'm not saying, I'm sure most of our church, that's probably true. When I'm talking about how do they feel about American church culture, how do they feel about coming to a building in the way that you have to relate to people once you get to the building? Okay? I'm highly introverted, but I'm also a full-time minister. And I'll tell you what kills me is what we call fellowship. All right? That little small talk, you know? What do we do 15 minutes before service or 15 minutes after service? Okay? There are a lot of young people, that just doesn't make a lot of sense to them. Okay? And so if we learn to separate these two, then I think what we're able to do is this. We're able to say, just because someone doesn't like doing church the way we do church, doesn't mean that they are not interested in becoming a disciple of Jesus. Second thing is this. I am on a board of one of our graduate theological schools. And so I actually get a lot of information. It's ATS, American Theological Schools. That's the accreditation agency for the whole nation in terms of seminaries beyond denominational lines. And in 2012, this is what they found out. This is pretty significant. What they found out in 2012, that 81% of incoming theological students, 81% do not want to go into a full-time church ministry. Okay? They want to do something else. They want to work at either a parachurch ministry or an organization, or they want to plant a church. Now, I find that to be really significant. Because you're talking about people who are willing to give up basically everything, get into a lot of debt to do theological education, but they don't want to work inside of our churches. Now, that's true for people who are actually going to seminary or graduate Bible departments. That highlights something that a lot of us are sensing. And that is the fact that there are fewer and fewer people who are willing to come to our church buildings no matter what we do. It doesn't matter how good your worship service is, okay? They're not coming. It doesn't matter how relevant your preaching is. They aren't coming, okay? Now, that's significant, and that's one of those issues that a lot of us really don't want to deal with, okay? Charles and I both, we were at a conference 2 years ago. There was some church leaders around. And they estimated this. And this is just it's a guess. It's an estimation. But for those of us who've been out there talking to non-Christians who are in the 20s and in their 30s, this rang true for us. They said it seems as if there are at least 40% of people in America who are not going to your church building. It doesn't matter what you do inside. They aren't going to. Now, I think that depends on where you're at, you know, where you're at in the country, all right? If you're in a Bible Belt place, you might have a larger percentage, but that's huge. And Charles and I, we were speaking, and that percentage is probably going to grow here. And so we're going to have to figure out a way to create Christian community for people who are not willing to come into our buildings. Now, let me say this before I move on. Where I'm not going, I'm not saying we need to give up our buildings. I'm not saying that. All right? I'm a church boy. I'm a third-generation preacher. I was thinking the other day, I'm 36 years old, and I can only remember not being in church on a Sunday morning 3 times. All right? When the roll is called up yonder, I'll be there with a pitch fight. I kind of like it, you know, the way we do church. But I'm dealing with the reality that a lot of people, 20s and 30s, are not. Okay. The next thing that I think we're going to need to be able to do, I'm kind of writing these out as principles. The first principle was simply that we should not equate how a person feels with American church culture with how they feel about Jesus and discipleship. The second thing I want you to know is that there's at least 40% of this group that will not be coming to church, no matter what you do to invite them. The third thing is this. I think it's going to be really important for us to distinguish between at least three groups of people. One is who I would call church people. These are people like me who grew up going to church. They had to go to church. Their parents made them go to church. The second group is who I would call the de-church. Okay? The de-church are people who have some church experience. They have some significant church experience, but at some point in time they stopped going to church. The third group I would call the unchurched. Now this is the group that I met as a student at the University of Florida. I had a lot of friends who actually did not grow up going to church. They say Generation X. Generation X is the first generation where at least half of us did not grow up going to church at all. Okay. Now, I'm going to make that distinction between the church, the church, and then the unchurched. And I'm going to go ahead and say this. There are a lot of church leaders who will only use the term church and unchurched. I know Dan Stanley in the book, Deep and Wide, he talked about reaching the unchurched. But they define the unchurched as anybody who hasn't been in church in the past 5 months. Okay? That's a different group. Somebody who's been in church for a while, all right, and somebody who's never been in church, that's a different group. Okay? The fourth category, I would say, are people who are anti-church. Okay? And the person who's anti-church could be somebody who's de-church and now they're just against it. Or the anti-church person could be somebody who is unchurched. But I think we need to keep those four groups of people in mind. And if you have a Bible or iPad or iPhone, whatever you hit young adult ministers do, grab your Bible and turn to Acts 15. I'm going to make a rough analogy here. And I don't want to push this analogy too far. But I think this will help us here. Acts 15, of course, is what I like to call the most important church meeting ever. Okay? This is coming from a guy, me, who hates church meetings. you remember, Paul has been out. Paul has been commissioned to reach the Gentiles. And word has gotten out that Paul is his ministry has gotten quite successful, but they're saying, okay, these Jewish Christians back at home base are saying, okay, we need to make sure to keep these Gentiles in line. Acts chapter 15, verse 1. Certain people came down from Judea to Antioch and were teaching the believers, unless you are circumcised according to the custom taught by Moses, you cannot be saved. And so the question here are about the boundary markers. James Dunn, New Testament scholar at Duke, I believe, said that first century Judaism, they basically had three boundary markers. Boundary markers are what does a person have to either believe, sign up for, or do if they're going to be a part of a group. All groups have. Okay, you think about political parties, right? Some, you know, political parties, if you're going to be a part of our party, you need to at least agree or do these things. Churches have them. Churches of Christ, what would our boundary markers be? Baptism for the remission of sins, Lord's Supper, and for a lot of people, sin, those would be boundary markers. James Dunn said that for first century Judaism, the three were, circumcision was one, dietary laws were the other, and Sabbath. Okay? If you think about it, what Jesus had to keep dealing with was what? Sabbath and some dietary laws as well. Paul had to deal with circumcision because Paul had to push out to the Gentiles. And so if you look at Acts 15, verse 5, it says, then some of the believers who belonged to the party of the Pharisees, right? The Pharisees have always been a part of the church. Yeah, we're not Latin or hard. Stood up and said the Gentiles must be circumcised and required to keep the law of Moses. Now, this is huge, right? Because if this would have gone through, this would have bring the camper, the mission to the Gentiles. My dad's from Louisiana. We're not giving up catfish. How many of you all are giving up bacon? All right? Not millions. Okay? And so you have this group who are saying this, and if you read any of N.T. Wright, if you don't read N.T. Wright, you really should. But what N.T. Wright and some others have said is this. If you look at what Paul is doing in the book of Romans, he's not just dealing with, does a person have to obey the law to be saved? What Paul is dealing with is this. what does a Gentile have to become culturally or ethnically a Jew before they can become, before they can be included in the people of God? How Jewish do Gentiles have to be? That's the bottom line. Okay? That's what's going on here. Acts chapter 15, verse 7, after much discussion, okay, I mean, this had gone on for quite some time. Basically, what they decided was this. They wanted the Gentiles to stay away from sexual immorality, from the meat of strangled animals, and to stay away from idols. But I think this whole time, this is one of the questions that Paul, I'm sure, was asking in some sense. What about the Gentiles? And you remember what they said in Acts chapter 15 is this. They said, listen, we don't want to make this any harder, Acts 15, verse 19. Let's not make this any harder on the Gentiles than is necessary. Acts 15, verse 19, James stood up. He said, it is my judgment, therefore, that we should not make it difficult for the Gentiles who are turning to God. What concerns me is this. I'm going to use this illustration. One of my professors in counseling used to be at the University of Indiana University. And they got a new president. And what this president did was really smart. Every time he built a building, he would build a building, and he would wait 2 years before he built a sidewalk. Do you know why he would wait 2 years? He wanted to see what path people naturally walk. Okay. Instead of doing what most people do, you build a building, then you build a sidewalk. And basically you tell them, if you want to get here, you have to walk this. Okay? We set up the sidewalks decades ago. And that sidewalk is, you need to make sure to come to our building 2 or 3 times a week if you are going to be discipled in Christ. And that's great for the people who are willing to do it. And there are still people who are willing to do it. This reason, I'm not saying give up on your buildings. I'm not saying that. There are people who are willing to come to buildings. There are 20s and 30-somethings who are willing to come to buildings.
You can send them to me, Eric.
Yeah, Matt. You know, they'll go to the building. I'm saying there is a larger, and it seems to be larger, percentage of these young people who are not. What about the Gentiles? What about this generation, the percentage of the generation that's not willing to come to the buildings? What are we going to do with them? Okay. This is what I want to get across. I'm being more descriptive here. When I get done in about 5 minutes, we'll take a 7-minute break, and Charles will be prescriptive. He'll tell you some things that they practice and have done. The question that I have is this. Does a person have to be a part of our established church culture in order to be a disciple? Let me ask that again. Does a person have to be a part of our established church culture to be a disciple? The answer for most of our churches is yes. We don't give them any other alternative. Okay? We give them no other alternative. Do they have to sit in pews, which is a pretty passive thing? Do they have to be willing to take communion facing the back of someone's head? Do they have to sing our songs, dress our way, and relate in what I would call how we relate cordially, but not vulnerably? What I'm saying is this. Say principle number 4. Is to reach more young people, to reach more of this generation, we are going to need groups, smaller groups, Christians who are willing to not be tethered to the church building. I'm not saying they need to stop going to our church building, but we are going to need groups of younger people who are willing to create Christian community outside of the church buildings and allow non-Christians to experience Christian community there. Okay. Some of you have heard the two terms gospel proclamation and gospel demonstration. Gospel proclamation and gospel demonstration. We need both of those. In the past, I've always viewed, first thing we need to do is we need to proclaim the gospel, meaning verbally. We need to preach the gospel, preach truth. This is who Jesus is. This is what we want. Then once we get people to sign in on that, then we'll go out and we'll be like Jesus, do those things. That's what they would call gospel demonstration. But then someone, I was reading some New Testament scholar in the book of Acts, and he said, if you notice what happens in the book of Acts, something will happen. Usually, it's the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit will do something. And then what you see Peter and the other apostles and teachers do, something will happen, and then they will teach and preach their sermon or message is based in part off of what just happened. Any of you who preach or teach, you know, that's a much easier way to do things, because you already have people's attention. Basically, a lot of their preaching and teaching was just answering. They were answering the question, why did this just happen? And that's something that we've experienced in our ministry. We can create Christian community that they can actually be a part of. Then they actually start having questions. One of the questions, why are you guys so nice to each other? I have a really diverse church. We have about 55-60% white Caucasian, about 25% African American. And then we have a number of international students. And our small groups usually reflect that. So people come into it. And I'm impressed. This is not because of me. This is true before I got to the church. My church is right off from the campus of the University of Florida. But I'm telling you, I probably have 25% of my adult members never went to college. Isn't that impressive? That they would be willing to go to a church called a campus Church of Christ, though they never went to a university. That's a testimony to the way my older members had treated them throughout the years. And they keep bringing their friends. Okay? And so people come in and they experience this. Right? Some people who are willing to come to the building, they experience it in the building. Others, they experience it as we've created, I'm going to use this term, Charles will speak more, as we've created a few missional communities outside where we invite them over to our home once a week. And they experience this. And they have questions. Then we teach, basically, to those questions. I'm not arguing that you need to change what you do on Sunday morning worship. And I hope you're catching this. I was in graduate ministry school at one of our colleges 11 years ago, 12 years ago. And the big thing back then was things we need to change about our worship service in order to draw in. I don't know if you've noticed this, but people aren't really talking about that anymore. Okay? I think it's two reasons. One is that most churches have already decided where they're going to be on that. I think the other reason people aren't talking about it anymore, because a lot of young people have decided, listen, we're actually beyond that. It's really not about what you're going to do on Sunday morning anymore. It's about what are we going to do outside of this building to make disciples. Tell you one more story. One more story. I was in Abilene, in school, working with this really small church, small black congregation, and there was this older guy who was there. He was a vet that had been married when he was younger, alone, didn't have, well, he had kids, but they couldn't stand him. He was really an hungry old guy. It was 1999, I remember that, New Year's Eve. Right before New Year's Eve, he asked me if I would spend New Year's Eve with him. You know? And I'm like, it's 1999. Yeah. Okay, I want to go out. I don't know what I'm going to do in that thing. I didn't want to be there, really. But, you know, my mother taught me well, so I had enough guilt. But I remember that night, we were talking, and he had some health problems. And I'm thinking to myself, hey, you need to go to the doctor and get this. I said, when's the last time you've been to the doctor? He was in his upper 80s. He said, I don't go to the doctor. You need to just go to the hospital to get checked up. He said, he said, don't you remember Tuskegee? I said, do I remember Tuskegee? I had taken African American history. Some of you know the Tuskegee. The Tuskegee experiment, 1927 to 1972. The U.S. Public Health, was funded by the U.S. Public Health, they went into Macon County, Alabama. Took 600 sharecroppers, African American men who were sharecroppers. They were poor. And they did not tell these men that they had syphilis. They knew they did. They told them they had bad blood. They were basically doing an experiment to see the effects of syphilis. And when it came out that penicillin could actually cure or control the symptoms, they didn't tell these men. They actually told them, no, don't take it. That's not going to help. It was a horrible moment in our history. They're all older. Black people still remember that. Right? That's waste time. Now, I'm going to be honest with you. Right? He told me that. I said, hey, I'm sorry that happened. Listen, you need to get over that. Okay? You need to go to the hospital. A few years later, I'm talking to some friends of mine who are graduate students in public health. And they tell me what some people have done, what some hospitals have done, especially in rural areas, is that they've realized that most of what we're going to do, what we need to do, the checkups, most of the care that they need, they don't need to come to the hospital for it. So they set up what they call mobile clinics. Right? Instead of these mobile clinics. And they have these healthcare workers who actually go out into their communities. And they're able to take care of 80% of what they need outside of that. And they see that there's two ways you can respond to this older man. One is the way I did. You need to get over it. Right? Or you can say, okay, are there ways that we can provide what Jesus would have us provide? Right? Without saying you have to walk alone outside. Let me make sure there's nothing else. We do have a handout with some questions there. Let me leave you with one other thing. Or a couple of other things. Some of the questions that I have is this. Who has God brought along your path? And I think you need to go back home. And you need to start asking the young adults that you have there. Who has God brought along your path? Or maybe inside your church. I know many of us, we still have visitors who come to our church. And this is what I want you to remember. That usually when God is at work in our lives, the results are not what we thought they would be. And this could be the danger of having a vision for your ministry. Because your vision for your ministry may not turn out the way you thought it would turn out. Remember Acts 10 and Acts 11. God was at work in Cornelius. But both the early church may have allowed many people, they were not expecting things to look that way. Okay. The other question that I had is, what about the 40%? What about the 40%? And the last question that I have here is, if you'll turn your Bibles to John 12. John 12. This has been a passage that has stuck with me for quite some time. And I'm kind of working with my elders and some of my church leaders. I'm trying to get us to honestly pray about this. John chapter 12, beginning with verse 23. John chapter 12, verse 20-22, we have Greeks who were coming to worship at the festival. Let me pause there. If you know the book of Acts really well, what you know is that there are basically three groups of people. You have the Jewish people, then you have the God-fearers. Do you know who the God-fearers were? The God-fearers were the people that Paul would, the first Gentiles that Paul would usually convert to the church. God-fearers were Gentiles who were willing to actually come to the synagogue. Right? These were Gentiles who actually had a respect for the Jewish people. They had a respect for Jewish culture and Jewish religion. They just weren't willing to be circumcised. There are a few things that man's not going to do, but he has to do it. Okay? So you got Jews, you got God-fearers, and then you have what we're going to call the Gentiles, people who had no relation to the synagogue. And that's kind of how I would talk about, once again, we have the church, we have the unchurched, and the de-church, or excuse me, the church, the de-church, and the unchurched. So we have these Greeks, John 12, verse 20. There were some Greeks who came along. They came to Philip. It's interesting. They